since very earliest times, men have always wondered what lay beyond the horizon. You're getting human imagination seeking to explain how geology and geography works, and adding bits and pieces to it. So suddenly great continents begin to emerge, which have now sank beneath the sea. The lost lands gradually filtered into the cultural pattern and cultural myth of society, and has come down to us. Places like Atlantis, places like El Dorado, places like Shangri-La. The futuristic city, which somehow lay in the South American jungle. The place of eternal peace and tranquility. A medieval Welsh kingdom from about the 12th century, which existed in southern Alabama. Wonderful land, full of gold and silver and wonderful fountains and miraculous creatures.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 3. It is March 9th, 2008, and this week we have an awesome episode on tap for you. We're going to be calling all the way to Northern Ireland to talk with Dr. Bob Curran, author of the amazing book, Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, Sunken Continents, Vanished Cities, and the Kingdoms That History Misplaced. And we're going to be talking about a ton of famous, infamous, and forgotten esoteric landmarks. Chances are you've heard of some of them. Chances are you haven't heard of other ones. Maybe you only know a little bit about some of them. Let me run down the list of locations we're going to be talking about just to give you a little sampling of what you're going to hear tonight. The Otherworld, Green Island, Atlantis, Lemuria, Davy Jones' Locker and the Flying Dutchman, Shangri-La, Shambhala, the Kingdom of Prester John, El Dorado, the Kingdom of Prince Madoc, the Fountain of Youth, the Green Children, the Library of Alexandria, and, of course, tons and tons more. Plus, we're going to talk about some of the key people in some of these stories, like Madame Blavatsky and the strange Nazi connection to some of these historic, esoteric landmarks that may or may not have existed. I had the pleasure of already listening to the interview a couple days ago, and it is a captivating conversation. Dr. Bob Curran, I think you're going to really like his style and his delivery. He is a storyteller, my friends. So sit back, relax, put your feet up, and enjoy this interview, because it's going to be a fun one to listen to, trust me. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Dr. Bob Curran, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Psychologist and historian Dr. Bob Curran has traveled the world in the study of mythology and folklore, which he has also extensively written and lectured about. He is the author of Vampires, Encyclopedia of the Undead, Celtic Lore and Legend, and Walking with the Green Men. He lives in Northern Ireland with his wife and family. He doesn't have a website, but we've got his email address here. He can be reached at Dr. Bob Curran, all one word, at yahoo.co.uk. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 4th, 2008. Dr. Bob Curran, talking about Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, on BOA Audio Season 3. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of Banal of America Audio. I know I say that week in and week out, it seems, but this time I really mean it was an ultra special edition. We're jumping across the Atlantic once again for another fascinating interview. We're going all the way to Northern Ireland. Our guest is Dr. Bob Curran, and what we're going to be talking about today is his outstanding book, Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms. I finished this last night. I cannot put this book over enough. It is fantastic.
I'd say it's a must-read for any student of the esoteric. There's so many places that people who study the esoteric have heard about, Atlantis, Lemuria, Shambhala, Shangri-La. That's just like three of the many that are profiled in the book. But we've heard of them so many times, and a lot of people just don't know the background of them, and this book really digs into them and does just a fantastic job of educating you as to the origins of these lost lands, forgotten realms, and, you know, were they real? Could they have existed somewhere? What do we know about these places? Dr. Bob Karn, as I said, has done an outstanding job looking into this mystery, into these series of mysteries, and he's here now on the program, direct from Northern Ireland, to discuss the book and to have a little conversation with us. So welcome to the show, Dr. Bob Karn.
Hello, Tim, and how can I follow that build-up?
Well, I'm telling you, Dr. Bob, you know, I haven't raved about a book like this in a few months now, but I really, really enjoyed it. Like I said, I can't put it over enough. It's fantastic, and I hope people go out and check it out.
Thank you very much.
Before we dive into Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, let's find out a little bit about you. Who is Dr. Bob Karn? You know, what's your bio, your background? How did you gravitate towards these mysteries that are the esoteric?
Well, Tim, I grew up in a very remote area of Northern Ireland, and their storytelling was a great pastime. If you could see me, Tim, you would know by the gray in my beard that I'm not a spring chicken, if I can say that. And a lot of our amusement was listening to stories, and I got involved in stories, particularly people who had been to other places. As I say, the area I grew up in was quite remote, and people who travel, let's say, to England or even America were considered to have traveled. So they came back and they told stories. And I suppose a lot of the stories stuck with me, and I wanted to know about places that were far away and things that were happening and things that were mysterious and things like that. So that was actually how I got into it. I became interested in history. I teach history, and I teach a bit of psychology. And so the two of them have come together, I think, in this book. So maybe that's what makes it so interesting. There's lost lands in us all, whether they be out there or whether they be within us.
Exactly. Yeah, you make that great point in the book. They may not be locations, but they may say more about the sociology of people than actually
absolutely
what the locations are all about.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just talk about what Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms looks into. Like we've said, mythical places and that kind of thing, but sort of give a thumbnail preview before we jump into some of the specific locations.
Okay, since very earliest times, men have always wondered what lay beyond the horizon. Now, people did travel along periods. I said at the start, people which I knew, whom I knew, came back from various other parts of the world, and they began to talk about wonderful things. And gradually, people began to look at what might be out there, what sort of people they might be, and what sort of marvels were there. Because some of the people who came back to him told them about things which they had no concept of. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them may have been true, some of them may have been false. There were stories, for instance, old travelers' tales of people who slept on their ears. They lay down on one ear and put the other ear over them like a blanket. There were stories of, and some of you, your listeners may know about this from Greek mythology, there were stories of great giants with one eye, and there were things about men who were half man, half horse. So all these wonderful tales began to, and gradually began to coalesce into a series of stories about places which might or might not exist. Some of them represented bits and pieces of history. Some of them simply were fragments of aspirations and longings and imaginings of the people. So the lost lands gradually filtered into the cultural pattern and cultural myth of society, and has come down to us. Places like Atlantis, places like El Dorado, places like Shangri-La. And if you travel around here, Tim, you will see many houses with Shangri-La up on them. So it must have slipped into the culture somehow.
Yeah, I sort of cherry-picked some of the areas here that are covered in the book and had some questions about them.
Okay.
And instead, you know, like I said, we're going to scratch the surface here in this interview. There's tons. How many would you say actual areas are profiled in the book?
I literally don't know, Tim. I just kept going. And between you and me, Tim, I had to cut out a whole number of lands, so there might even be a second book.
Oh, wow, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say in the book, each area that you discuss, each lost land that you discuss could be a book in and of itself. So like I said, we're just going to scratch the surface here.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive in on the other world, which is one of the first places profiled in the book. Talk a little bit about the other world.
The other world, from my own point of view, was a realm in Celtic mythology. When people died or when they disappeared, they may have went to the other world. Now, I was telling you that I can go out and see. I'm not too far from the sea. So you can go out and you can look at the massive cloud formations off a little place down the road called Port Stewart. And the clouds gather together into shapes of mountains and things like that. And I suppose for many people, in Massachusetts, you have, on a beautiful day, looked up at the clouds, and you can see all sorts of shapes. You can see castles, you can see buildings, you can see things like that. And I suppose that conjured up to people something of a mysterious other world. Now, that fed into their belief, and they believed that there was another land just beyond human comprehension, which was which they could see, but which they couldn't touch, except they were extra special. Now, it meant that perhaps poets or great men went to these other places. And this was the world of the fairy. This was the world, perhaps, even of the dead. It was a paradisical land. It was beautiful in some respects. In other respects, people who went there did not age. So if you returned, as I think I mentioned Oisin did, 100 years have passed, even in a day. So everybody you know is dead, and the world has changed. So the other world lay just beyond human comprehension. We could see it, perhaps on the clouds on the horizon or the clouds over the fields, but we could never get to it except we were somebody special. Maybe Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton will get there.
And one of the parts of the book that you talk about in the other world section is that there were some weird stories from the 1800s where people would see these cloud formations and really it would create quite a frenzy in the town. They would believe that there was a town across there.
Absolutely. I mentioned Port Stewart to you there, which is just about 4 or 5 miles down the road from where I'm talking to you. In the 1800s, there was actually a mirage which appeared. Now, a mirage is something which appears and is really not there, and travelers see them in the desert, and things created by various atmospheric conditions. But some of it appeared, and even off the coast of Scotland, off the coast of Southern Ireland, and men actually tried to row out to get them. They could see castles, they could see houses, they could actually see people walking on the roads. Now, perhaps that was a reflection of something somewhere else, but that began to develop a sort of mystical quality, and whenever you rowed out to it, and it disappeared, then it became even more mystical because you had actually seen it, but it wasn't there. So it could be something from another zone, another time, and it may well have been from another place on the earth.
A point I wanted to make here that's in the book, in the section here on High Brazil, is that it appeared on a lot of maps, that some of these places would be on maps and stuff like that during the time period, and even though from what we can ascertain, they're not out there in the ocean or something like that.
Absolutely. Remember that many of the cartographers, those people who made the maps, had never traveled outside the town in which they lived and relied on the stories of sailors coming back as to their impression of what the world was like. So if the sailor said, well, you know, there was an island out there, we thought we glimpsed an island on just along the horizon, the map maker would say, well, this man has been out there, he has seen this thing, I haven't, so I'm going to put it in my map. And so a number of lands began to appear. Now, there was a very famous one which had no basis at all in geography, which is literally not far from me. And on old maps of Rathlin Island, which lie off the north coast of Ireland, there is an island marked called the Green Island. And that came from an old folk tale which said that fairies lived there. And the island appeared only once every 7 years. And that people travelled to it to actually work for the fairies. That meant to bring in their harvests and to gather their potatoes, because it was assumed that the fairies lived exactly the same way that we did. Mm-hmm. There are stories. In fact, I've just been collecting a story about a woman who claims to have went and lived on the fairy island. So that, with all these stories floating about, those who made the maps decided that they would put it on just off the coast of Rathlin. So they have it marked on some very old maps as the Green Island or the Shamrock Island. Once again, and you mentioned it, High Brazel. They assumed that High Brazel lay somewhere out in the North Atlantic because people had seen something, perhaps the back of a whale, perhaps a reef which was then submerged or something like that. And it became such a central myth that some Spanish sailors who believed it, or Portuguese sailors, I should say, who believed it, actually named the country of Brazil after it because they thought they had landed there. There you are.
One person who shows up a lot in the book, who seems like she's pretty responsible for repopularizing, if that's even a word, many of
what
these,
is, yeah, you're right.
Okay, good. Many of these locations is Madame Blavatsky. I didn't realize she had such an integral role in bringing these areas back into the popular culture.
Helena Petrovna Blavatsky was a great esoteric lady. Now, depending on how you view her, some people think she was a great thinker. Some people think she was a great fraud. She drew on many of the myths which were floating about at the time. Now, Madame Blavatsky believed that she was in contact with a series of great masters who lived somewhere in Tibet and who, in some cases, communicated to her by a cuckoo clock, sending her messages. Now, they gave her a sort of potted history of the world, which had talked about great continents like Atlantis or Lemuria or Mu, in which there had been various ages of creatures who had lived on this world, whether or not they were the forerunners of man or whether they were something else. And she wrote extensively on this and drew up on many of the old myths in order to support her views of theosophy about the age of the world and to give greater credence to her views of the occult and how people could get various powers and know various things and gain various knowledge and things like that. So she wrote extensively, and she had a great influence because she was writing at a time when the world was being explored and new things were being found out. She was writing at the beginning of end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, and this was a period of expansion when people were beginning to expand into new areas of the world. And so she was part of that and had a tremendous influence on that period of time, and has some of her writings have come down to us.
Talk a little bit about Atlantis, because that's sort of the big daddy of lost lands and forgotten realms. It seems to be the biggest, most popular, or the most famous lost place as it is, and it's a strange sort of history in the sense that the original source is just Plato and you know, passing through the story they wrote. And other than that, you know, we don't know too much about whether it was even in the history or not. So it's a fascinating story.
Well, Tim, that represents what I would term the historical and the imaginary, or the hopes and aspirations, the aspirational. Because Atlantis, and I think this is why the myth or the story of Atlantis has endured for so long, because it represents, to some extent, it represents our hopes and ideals. Whenever I was growing up, Atlantis was somewhere beneath the North Atlantic, so it was said, and it had once been a great civilization. I remember reading old books which suggested that they had cars and they had aeroplanes and all sorts of things. That was a tremendous futuristic civilization, and it was a benign civilization. Now, what the early writers tell us about Atlantis was that it was nothing of the sort. It lay beyond the Pillars of Hercules, according to some people. Some writers from the Mediterranean region, and that was actually outside their sphere of influence, so it was practically in an unknown part of the earth. And it was very barbaric. It was a slave society. The people there were very militaristic and incredibly warlike, and they raided around the Mediterranean, and they were destroyed by a great cataclysm. Now, that may be part of an old folk memory, which comes from the Minoan civilization, which actually existed within the Mediterranean area. The only part of that civilization which remains, because the civilization was probably destroyed by a massive volcanic eruption, the only part of that civilization which remains is the island of Santorini in the Greek archipelago, and that is black and volcanic. And is probably, roughly, if Atlantis did exist, where it would have existed. Now, it was probably not called Atlantis. It was probably part of the of a very early Minoan civilization, which we know existed, because we have pots and shards from that. But that exploded a long, long time ago.
Let's talk a little bit about the strange sort of evolution of the story of Lemuria, because I found it interesting that it sort of started out in a very benign way, a theory of how the species of lemurs may have been dispersed, and then it turned into this fantastical tale of a lost civilization and everything else. That's a strange sort of evolution. It kind of tells you a lot about people in and of itself.
Well, once again, that is a combination, I would argue, of what actually happened with the evolutionary and the spread, as you say, of the lemurs and land bridges. And it combines with part of the age-old query about where people came from and where men and races and creatures began to evolve, or where did they actually come from. So you have a sort of geological thing mixing with people beginning to speculate on how men were dispersed or creatures were dispersed over the earth. So you have the geological, because the earth looked very different back in various periods of time than it does now. And possibly creatures moved from one part to the other. And you have then the imagination, you have the explanation. People say, well, how did this race get from A to B? Were they a seafaring people? No, they weren't. So there must have been some sort of great continent there. And that begins to give us an explanation, which we can deal with. Then bits and pieces of the imagination is added to it. For instance, there must be have been at one stage a great civilization. The people came, let's say, to America. The people live under Mount Shasta. And they are benign and wonderful beings because they could travel about all over the place. So you're getting human imagination seeking to explain how geology and geography works. and adding bits and pieces to it. So suddenly great continents begin to emerge, which have now sank beneath the sea. And quite possibly there were continents, but they may not have been as we imagine them.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to think about the way people are and stuff like that, and the way
Absolutely.
Society is.
Absolutely. And I was talking to a gentleman not so long ago, and we were talking about the Red Indians. And he said, well, he says, you know, he says, the Red Indians are possibly descendants of the Chinese. And so, once again, he was talking about a myth of a continent somewhere which had given both the Chinese and the Red Indians to the world. There you are.
Yeah.
You pays your money, you take your choice.
There you go. Speaking of sinking beneath the sea, let's talk about a popular location here, the popular lost land, forgotten realm that's been really popular in the last few years, and that's the Davy Jones locker story and how that ties into the Flying Dutchman. You know, if someone's seen Pirates of the Caribbean, it's not like that at all.
It isn't, because Davy Jones sort of emerges as this sort of tentacled H.P. Lovecraft sort of figure. No, actually, we believe that there was a gentleman called David Jones, but he was not the Davy Jones of the locker. David Jones, as far as I can, was a pirate, possibly of Welsh origin, who operated out of Port Royal, Jamaica, before it was destroyed by an earthquake. And he operated there in about 1630, 1631. But he was of literally no consequence in piratical terms. Notion of Davy Jones' locker, which they say may have come from a variety of sources. Firstly, the name Jones. I know the name Jones is Welsh, but some have argued that it was a derivation of Jonah. Jonah, as you may remember, was the prophet whom God sent to Nineveh to tell them to behave themselves and mend their ways. And Jonah refused to go and set out on a ship for another port and was swallowed by the great whale and vomited up on the beach. So Jonah became a figure that was bad luck on boats. Now, the Davy, they argue, may be a word for the devil, or it may come from the West Indian Duppy, which is a ghost or a specter in Caribbean and Creole mythology. So it might, how the name has come about, there may also have been a connection to a gentleman who actually did keep a locker. Now, here, as I'm sure there was in the United States, there was a series in various ships of impressment. Now, this meant that captains of ships who pulled into ports and found their crews, they didn't have enough crew to continue with their voyage, particularly naval ships, were allowed to impress men from the local area to serve on the ship wherever it was going. Now, many young men didn't want to go and leave their homes and their wives and whatever, so there was a series of landlords who kept lockers. Now, whenever young men got very, very drunk, they were tossed into these lockers and waited for what were called press gangs, the impressment gangs, who then carried them out and threw them into the boats. Whenever you sobered up, you found you were on a ship bound for the West Indies. So there was a number of notorious landlords, one of whom was supposed to be Davy Jones, who kept a beer locker into which he threw these men. There was also an old song at the time, which was called When Jones's Ale Was New, and it talks about men coming to, strangely enough, there's not a sailor among them. There were four jovial fellows. One was a soldier, one was a dyer, one was a tinker, and one was a mason. But the name Jones stuck because it is possible that this song was what was called a capstan song. Whenever the crews were winching up the anchor, they sang a song. Or another thing which they did was haul a bowline, which was pulling a rope to change the direction of a sail on a sailing ship. And they sang these songs, and the name Jones may well have stuck. But he could be a Creole ghost. He could be an English gentleman, because there was a gentleman in Bristol supposedly called David Jones who kept an ale locker into which he threw drunk men in order to wait for the impressment gangs. Or he could have been a figure in a song, which was sung on various sailing ships.
The Flying Dutchman, that was a real person, correct?
That was a gentleman, and I have to watch how I say this on radio. He was called Bernard Fuck.
It's okay, we're on the internet.
he was called Bernard Fuck. Now, this was in the days of the great tea clippers, in which tea was brought from the plantations of the West Indies to places like Bristol and Portsmouth to be sold. Mm-hmm. And as well as that, from the New World, from America. And these ships were owned by various companies who competed with each other in order to get their goods to the ports first so that they could have the best sales. And there were races between the tea clippers. And Fock was allegedly born in Rotterdam, sorry, and was the captain of one of these ships and was a very fast. He made very, very good time because they had to sail around a place called the Cape of Good Hope at the foot of Africa, which was very stormy and which held the ships up. But Fock seemed to be able to get through this, and he became known as Der Vlieglander Hollander, the Flying Dutchman, because he was of Dutch nationality. And he was supposedly able to get round the Cape of Good Hope in record time, which led to the notion that he was using some sort of supernatural powers. And so the Flying Dutchman became a sort of nickname for him. And the story was that he had sold his soul to the devil, and that he could get round the Cape of Good Hope and be in Bristol, Portsmouth, or whatever, before any of his rivals. That led to the notion that whenever he died, he was doomed to sail the seas forever, particularly the seas off the Cape of Good Hope. Many people claimed to have seen him or his ship. The name then became transferred actually to the ship. Fock's ship is never given a name, and it is assumed that he sailed about two or three ships. But the Flying Dutchman became equated with the ship itself. And later on, it became associated with Davy Jones. And that's why you find in the film Pirates of the Caribbean, Davy Jones is captain of the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite a journey there.
It is.
I learned actually a lot of things here from the book, but one mystery that was cleared up for me, Shambhala and Shangri-La, those are actually the same place.
They are. I told you earlier that whenever you go around here, you'll see a number of houses which are called Shangri-La. Mm-hmm. Now, Shangri-La here in Ireland always usually refers to people who have retired and who have bought a house and who are well settled and have settled down into their twilight years, and this is where they're living. And Shangri-La was supposedly the place of eternal peace and tranquility, and where everything was almost perfect. Shangri-La was supposed to be a place in the Himalayas. Now, it became very famous in the 1930s when the film Lost Horizon was released. And it was the film, for those who don't know it, was about a plane crash in the Himalayas and the survivors being rescued by wonderful monks and taken to a place of great tranquility and beauty. There may well have been monasteries in the Himalayas to which the lamas or the monks retired, and there actually is a story about monks coming from a hidden valley somewhere up, because Shangri-La was supposed to be a hidden valley, somewhere up in the Himalayas, to one of the local kings on the edge of Bhutan in the country of Kag, and making representations to him, and then disappearing off again. So there probably were monasteries or retreats or hermitages or so which the monks used. Now, there were probably nothing like great havens of tranquility, or this has been put into by the sort of 20th century mind. Mm-hmm. Whenever things get too much for us, Tim, I don't know about you, but sometimes I wish there was a place I could escape to. Maybe you suffer the same, but which you can escape to and have a nice quiet time and maybe reflect on things and need to think about, like, me time.
Yeah.
So maybe Shangri-La, while it may well have been a historical place, has become equated in our minds with tranquility, with beauty, with peace, and with sort of restorative powers, a place that you can recharge your batteries. That may be the origin of Shangri-La. Yes, Shambhala, which was sought after by the Nazis.
Yeah.
In the 1930s and early 40s, was in the Himalayas. Now, the Nazis had a very, very different agenda. They weren't looking for a place which was full of rest and tranquility. No, they were looking for a place from which the Aryan race may have come, because there were stories in the mountains, and I touch on some of them. There's places like Hyperborea, the land behind the wind, and places like that, which were supposed to be where races, some of the early races came from, and this harks back once again to what we were talking about earlier to Madame Blavatsky. And the Nazis were anxious to find if there was anything which would give credence to Hitler's belief that there was a superior race or a master race which had once ruled in the world. And it was thought that perhaps this might be found in the Himalayas or in the edges of Tibet. And certainly in 1939, expeditions were sent from Germany into Tibet to look around for somewhere like Shambhala, from which the Aryan race was said to emerge. Shambhala may well be underground. We're not sure, but they began to look around for evidences of this, which would give credence to the Nazi philosophy of the master race. And it was thought that they might have found it there. I don't think they found very much. In fact, I know they returned empty-handed. But it once again reflected the hopes, the aspirations of the people who were looking for it.
And it's just fascinating to think within the last 100 years or so that people were still, you know, mounting these serious expeditions to find these places. It's not
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another area of significance, really in a historical way, in a political sort of way, and that's the Kingdom of Prester John. I had never heard of this story. The whole aspect of the letter being sent was fascinating, and then how Christian powers that be tried to assign the Kingdom of Prester John to various people in a way to sort of bolster their standing in the world. Let's talk about the Kingdom of Prester John.
The Kingdom of Prester John was a medieval story. It is said that the Byzantine Emperor Manuel I received somewhere around the 1140s, received a letter from an East European king, an East European Christian king named Prester John, and it was a letter asking for help. Prester John ruled a Christian country somewhere in the Far East, and that country was under threat by barbarians, possibly Tartars or possibly Mongols, and he wrote to the Byzantine Emperor for help and support. Now, the Byzantine Emperor simply put the letter away and did absolutely nothing about it. And it was thought that the Kingdom of Prester John was overwhelmed. It became a fascinating story. All sorts of things were ascribed to it. They ascribed the fact that Prester John was in fact descended from one of the three magi, the wise man who had attended at Jesus' crib, in the biblical story.
Yes.
Some people said that it was a wonderful land, full of gold and silver and wonderful fountains and miraculous creatures. Now, whether or not Prester John existed, he became a sort of focus for the Christians of the for Christianity in the East. And as you quite rightly say, some people used it to raise their own standing and say, here there are kings of the East, and we should have helped them when we got the chance. They're now overwhelmed. Some of them were supposedly Mongol, the descendants of Prester John were supposedly Mongol princes. For instance, it was thought that when he was called King David of India, he was actually Temujin, who became Genghis Khan, and welded the eastern steppes together. Others said, of course, that Prester John may have ruled over a slightly different type of Christianity, a Christianity which was nearer Buddhism. And this is why the emperor did not help him, because he knew they were Nestorian Christians, which, as I say, was slightly closer to Buddhism than it was to the Christianity of the West. And there were Christians living there. Other people said that Prester John lived in Ethiopia, and this moved the notion of Prester John's kingdom from the East to North Africa. And it was thought that Haile Selassie was a descendant of Prester John, and depending on whom you speak to, some of the Rastafarians still believe that. So there's all sorts of, it's mixed with Christianity, it's mixed with the Mongol Empire, and it's mixed with Rastafarianism.
Yeah, it's strange to see the permutations that Prester John takes on over the years as they try to use that story.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I was sailing for 2.5 weeks. They're in due west. And making 9 knots, I should have been in Fiji in less than a week. But the first piece of land I saw wasn't Fiji, was it? No. No, it was here, this island. And you know why? Because this is it. This is all there is left. This ocean and this place here. We are stuck in a bloody snow globe.